Began our discussion on giving last week by looking at the example of Macedonians. And if you remember, one of the things that we emphasized in that example is indicated in verse 2, in the great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. And I think this is key. It's something that's going to be an aspect of this theme that we'll see repeated throughout the 8th and 9th chapters, is that we are called to liberality with regard to our giving, and that our liberality is based in basically two things, our love and our zeal. And this is certainly the case with regard to the Macedonians. Their care and concern for the brethren in Judea motivated them to be benevolent. The zeal that they showed. And that was evident in that they gave first to the Lord and then to the brethren. Notice the statement made in verse 5 of the text. With regard to the gift of giving, not only as we hope, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So again, zeal is what's under consideration here. The dedication that they showed toward God, the fact that it didn't matter what was required, they were willing to do whatever it was that they were able to do. Now, there is a principle that we want to understand with regard to giving. It's one that I almost hesitate to bring up because I don't want to in any way discourage liberality. But I do want you to understand that there is a reality that we need to acknowledge, and that is we, each and every one of us, could give every single penny that we have, become destitute ourselves in that regard, and that needs would remain. There would continue to be needs that would be present. And so I think sometimes there is a wrong-mindedness that exists in the world concerning the reality of the circumstances of mankind, to where individuals feel like that if sufficient effort is made on the part of certain groups, that would alleviate the suffering that is in the world. And it's not the way it works. Jesus even acknowledged that. You'll remember when the alabaster flask was broken and he was ministered to, and there were some objections that were raised. He said, the poor you have with you always, but me you will not have with you always, indicating that what had been done was appropriate under those particular circumstances. And I think that we need to acknowledge and recognize that it is important for us to have a giving heart, for us to be liberal with regard to our benevolent actions and words, but that we also should be practical and realistic with regard to the extent of what can be accomplished. And I think as a result of not being that realistic, there are individuals who make mistakes. For example, projects and ministries, quote, and actions that are not authorized by God are entered into with the grand purpose of in the sharing of benevolence to ease suffering. And so we want to talk a little bit as we in discuss this particular call for us to be liberal and to be abundant. We want to talk about the limited scope of benevolent activity as well. And that is especially true with regard to what God charges local congregations with in the realm of benevolent activity. And just something to kind of keep in mind. In this particular case, we have individuals who gave sacrificially. They did not have much themselves, but they were very liberal in what they gave because of others who were more destitute. There's a reason for that. I want you to notice as we get into the verses 8 and following, a statement beginning in verse 12 of that text and going down kind of bears upon what I'm saying. He says, if there is a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has and not according to what he does not have. I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, that their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Of course, that's a reference to the gathering of manna as the children were wandering in the wilderness in Judea. But what he's talking about is in the realm of benevolence. He's not desiring that you become destitute through giving. In other words, that you give everything away and then not have the ability or wherewithal to care for yourself. That puts you in the circumstance that the individual that you are seeking to help is presently in. So really not much has been accomplished there. But rather the intent with regard to benevolence is to supply to individuals those things that are needful for them, so that there, as indicated in this text, may be an equality. And the idea of equality, by the way, is not indicating that everybody has exactly the same amount, but rather that everyone has what they need to have or must have with regard to subsistence. And that's something that was lacking in Judea at this particular time, which was the reason for the need for such liberality and giving on the part of other Christians. So we have the example of Macedonians in chapter 8, and going down from verse 8 to 15, we have a second point that is established in this regard, and that is the nature of our example and who it is that we should emulate. Well, notice in verse 9, he said, "You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. And in this I give advice, it is to your advantage, not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you must also complete the doing of it, that there, that as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion out of what you have." And then he talks about the willingness of mind and this equality. So he uses Christ as an example. There are a couple of things that we look at with regard to the example of Christ. The first one is the obvious one, how much he gave up. In Philippians, the second chapter, the Apostle Paul refers to the position that he had at the right hand of the Father, but he willingly divested himself of that position to come to earth as a man and to suffer the indignities of the cross. This is something he willingly did because there was something that we lacked. What we were lacking, what we could not supply for ourselves, Christ had and could supply for us, and he was willing to do that. And so it is an indication of his love and devotion that led to a great liberality on his part. He gave up a lot for us. Second thing to note is the willingness to see through to the end the obligation that he had, the commitment that he had made. So Jesus came to this earth. He came for the express purpose of redeeming man. That was his reason for coming. You'll remember that there were a number of different occasions where either by persecution or by temptation, that stumbling blocks were placed in his way to where he could have faltered. He did not falter on any of those occasions. He persisted in the work that God had given him to do, and he accomplished it. Example that we may allude to is in the Garden of Gethsemane as he prayed on the night of his betrayal, because that's the most obvious relating of that that agony that he felt and how difficult the burden was that he bore on our behalf. So that he sweated great drops as of blood and prayed fervently for a long period of time. "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." So it was not an easy thing that he did. It was a very difficult thing that he did. It was a great sacrifice that he made on our behalf. But it was something he had committed himself to do. And so rather than taking leave of that responsibility, of perhaps reneging on his obligation, he persisted to the point of death on the cross. And as such, he became the Redeemer of mankind. And I think that perhaps in this, though we recognize the liberality of our Lord, that the reason why the apostle Paul gives Christ as an example in this case was to indicate to them, as you've made a commitment to the Judean brethren, and you need to follow through with it. And so this letter is a warning. Remember, he made reference to the responsibilities that they had to lay by in store as they had been prospered in his first letter. And he persists with regard to this, talking about the importance of finishing what they had committed. And that obligation is there. So, with regard to commitment, and of course, this is applicable in any aspect of our life. If we make a commitment, then we need to fulfill that commitment. No man, having put his hand to the plow and turning back, is fit for the kingdom of heaven. A king who goes to war, before he determines to go to war, he has to determine whether he can, with his relatively few, defeat the one who has many. And there is a commitment that has to be made. And that's certainly the case with regard to us as Christians. And by the way, it is applicable not only in the area of benevolence, but in every aspect of our life. If you're going to marry a wife, then that's a commitment that is a lifetime commitment that requires many things of you, and you have to fulfill that commitment. If you're going to father a child, or mother a child, birth a child, then there is a commitment there, and an individual should recognize what that commitment is and follow through with that commitment. If you are affiliating yourself with a local congregation with regard to work and worship, then that's a commitment. And you have a responsibility to fulfill that commitment. And of course, primarily and certainly, there is that commitment to God. People talk about the impossibility of apostasy, and that's, I think, one of the absurdities of this. The idea that I can make a commitment, I can give myself to the Lord, but not fulfilling that commitment, not following through with that commitment, has no bearing upon my eternal standing. God requires full devotion and complete devotion for the entirety of our life. And an individual who puts his hand in the plow and looks back, not worthy. That's kind of one of the peculiar things about the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints, is that they have to take that passage that you put your hand in the plow and look back, you're not fit for the kingdom, but you're going to get to be a part of the kingdom anyway, even though you're not fit for it. And that's just not the way it works. We have to be steadfast in our commitment. Christ was. We're glad for that. Our eternal standing with God is and was dependent upon his fulfilling his commitment. And we need to fulfill ours as well. So keep that in mind as an aspect of the responsibility that we have to give of our means on the first day of the week. That's something that we, as we have been prospered, are to do. And so individuals who renege on that, then there is a problem. With regard to giving, we're going to look, we've talked about an individual purposing in his heart. We're talking and we'll continue to talk about the importance of being consistent and systematic in giving. I want you to notice chapter 9 and verse 5, just to kind of allude to this since I am going beyond again a bit of the scope and getting ahead. You'll notice the statement that he makes in chapter 9 and verse 5. I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your generous gift beforehand, which you have previously promised. Again, this has to do with commitment. That it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation. And so this, again, has to do with zeal. It has to do with love and motivation. It has to do with putting Christ first. But with regard to our giving, and when we're talking about giving, it's not giving to the church. We need to kind of get that out of our head. It's a gathering that is done in the local assembly. But what we're actually doing is giving to the Lord. And that's why the commitment must be first. It must be paramount. And we cannot renege on that. We cannot think that other things have come up that are more important than giving to the Lord. We are to give first to the Lord. We're to give as we have purposed. We're to give liberally. And we are to prepare so as to be generous in our giving, so that there is not a grudging hostility to it. That I've got to sacrifice in another place, or I've got to change my plans because there isn't sufficient preparation. And I think sometimes people get that idea with regard to giving on the first day of the week, that this is something that is either of lesser importance than other things, that it's something that is optional, that it's something that can be haphazard. And what we're finding in this particular text is not only the concept of liberality and zeal, but also the importance of commitment and preparedness that is established in this context. And again, the wonderful thing about this is the practical nature of it. In other words, the principles are not theological principles that have no practical application. The theological principles are established by the Apostle Paul's practical advice to the Corinthians as to how to go about the preparation of this gift for benevolence for the Judean saints. And so we can learn much from that. All right? So keep in mind that particular example of the Lord in chapter 8 in verses 8 through 15. The next section in verses 16 through 24 of chapter 8 is not central to our discussion of the subject of giving and the various attributes or aspects of giving. It has to do with the various aspects of actually accomplishing the removing of the gift from them to the saints in Judea, and how that can be accomplished, the importance of honorableness on the part of the one who would take the gift. So we're going to just kind of set that aside. It's a good study, but it's not one central to our particular emphasis. And I want you to go down to chapter 9. And chapter 9 and into, in fact, the entirety of that text, there are some important things that are mentioned. So he talks in verses 4 and 5 about the Macedonians possibly coming with me and finding you unprepared. So there is that call that we've already alluded to the need for preparation. That leads to, in verse 6 of the text, and going down through verse 15, some specific principles of giving that he the establishes. And again, I do want to emphasize this. I think it's important that the application of the principles that are established here are broadly applicable. In fact, I think that when we look at the principles themselves, we can look at other places in Scripture where they are applied with regard to ministry, applied with regard to our personal devotion to God, all those kinds of things, generosity, liberality, zeal, those kinds of things. But he's making the application here to what you take out of your pocket and what you give. And remember that the context here is in the realm or area of benevolence, but it has to do with the gift that is given to the Lord and the giving that we give to Him. So, in verse 6, principle number 1, he said, "He who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will reap bountifully." So the first principle is one of liberality. And by the way, with regard to the call for liberality, the resultant blessings that accrue to the individual who gives liberally. And this is not the gospel of health and wealth that is mentioned here. That's not what we're referring to. Some people will take this passage and they'll say, if you give X amount of your money to the church, that God is going to, in return, bless you economically, so you'll become rich, or you'll become more wealthy as a result of those things. Not saying that it could not happen, but not that it's something that is promised. What we need to recognize here is the sense of obligation and duty in this area. So we could say the same thing with regard to Bible study. If you sow sparingly, you're going to reap sparingly. If you sow bountifully in the area, you put the time in, you put the effort in, then you're going to reap great benefits. We could say the same thing with regard to your prayer life. You don't pray very often, then you're not going to get as much out of that with regard to either fulfillment of requests or petitions made to God, the wonderful benefits that come as a result of offering up the fruit of our lips and praise to God. Those things are not going to be present in your life because you're not making an effort at it. And so I think that the application that we should make here would have to do with our spiritual benefits that come as a result of the liberality that we show in our giving. That can be seen with regard to the thanksgiving on the part of those who receive the gift. It could have to do with the blessings and benefits that would come to us if at some future point in time we too are suffering, and the desire and willingness on the part of others to return in kind the kindnesses and benevolence that we've offered to them, but especially with regard to the pleasure of God and the fact that God is pleased with what we do. So the idea, the principle of sowing what we reap and in measure is something that's established very clearly in verse 6 of the text. Second point, verse 7, let each one give as he purposes in his heart. And again, this indicates something that is not haphazard, but rather something that is systematic, something that takes not only effort, but it takes planning on our part. Now, we talked about this as we began our study of this section, and that is, if you ask me the question, how much should I give? I'm not going to give you an answer to that because I don't know the circumstances of your life. I don't want to know those things. I don't know how much money you make. I don't know what your bills are. I don't know what your obligations are and such. All I can tell you is that there are certain principles that are established that we've already alluded to. Liberality, zeal, love, sacrificial giving. And this is another one that is found in this particular text. Give as you have purposed in your heart. Now that begs the question, our heart must be a heart that is attuned to God's things, what God desires for us. So if a man's heart is right, and he determines in his heart what it is he's going to give, then he's not going to give as he should. So the heart needs to be right first. But there are an awful lot of people that have a good heart, but they're not systematic, and they're not planning their giving. And as a result, it ends up that it's something that is done grudgingly out of necessity or as a matter of obligation rather than something that is done generously. So purposing in the heart is something that is extremely important. Purposing the heart would preclude grudging giving or giving out of necessity because you have to. As you've made that decision, you've determined that it's something that is certainly less stressful as far as practical application because it's done out of a loving heart. It is something that will be more bountiful and sacrificial.
Kyle Jensen. So Josh is standing over there. He wanted to give some input.
Okay.
back at verse 6, I see this as a bit of a proverb, you might say. As many verses are with proverbs, they don't have a necessarily immediate or physical consequence. Such as the unrighteous meeting their judgment. A lot of people read some of those proverbs, and we're like, well, it can't be true that all the time the unrighteous meet their punishment because many go all their lives without ever receiving punishment. Well, no. That's thinking very short term. God will take care of that. They will not escape the punishment. So, the same here. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Sure, that can have a physical application, but much more so, at the end of our lives, a very spiritual application. As Jesus himself talking about the judgment told those who never visited him in prison, clothed him when he was naked, fed him when he was hungry. Well, Lord, when did when did we see you in prison? When did we see you naked? When were you hungry? Well, if you didn't do it to the least of these, my children, then you did not do it to me. And the same for having done it. So, you may not see the sparing or the bounty here on earth, but it will be needed in judgment.
Okay, good. Very good point. Continuing on with regard to this, the next principle in verse 7 is cheerfulness. So, purposing in our heart and cheerfulness in giving. And by the way, those two things are tied together. That is, as an individual gives as his purpose, it enables him to give cheerfully. This is kind of a situation. Let's say a Christian has a sense of duty and sense of ought. He knows that he's given a responsibility, but he doesn't make the plans to do so. And so now comes time that his obligation that he has made is due. But because he has a plan, he's not in a situation or circumstance where he is easily able to offer the gift. He has that sense of duty. He knows it's his responsibility to offer the gift, but it's not going to be something easily done because plans have not been made. And so he gives the gift. Now, the gift may be less liberal in that regard. It may be more sparing. But he gives the gift, but he doesn't have a cheerful heart as he gives because of the problems that surround the giving of it because of lack of preparation. And so the two things are tied together. But I've said this, and I speak somewhat facetiously in using this language, but it's not enough that you give liberally, but you have to like it. And I think there is something to that in this particular text. It goes back to the idea of having a loving heart, to be zealous for the Lord, to purpose in your heart, to give to the Lord first and then give a gift, all of those kinds of things that we've talked about in the context leading up to here, is the fact that this is something that as we acknowledge the nature of God's gift to us, it's something that we should enjoy doing. It's something that should be pleasurable to us. It's something we can do cheerfully. And so yes, the Apostle Paul is saying, you have a commitment, you have an obligation. You need to fulfill that, but you need to do it with a proper spirit, a proper mindset. And I think that if we could reach the point, each of us, where because of the mindset, because of our commitment, because of our love, that we rejoice in the opportunity to give, that our giving would be as a group. How anybody does, but as a group would be even more. And so much that way, you know, preachers, it's a reality. And in fact, the Apostle Paul and Peter and others refer to the reality, how that we have to continually remind, to stir up by way of remembrance, to admonish, to exhort, those kinds of things. But it's an interesting thing. If you look at all of the principles that are established with regard to the Christian life, if everyone was a self-starter with regard to these things, if there was that full commitment and that full realization of what God has done for us, and the natural commensurate response was present in the lives of all Christians, then preachers would be out of a job. There wouldn't be that need of admonition and exhortation. Elders wouldn't be in need of a job with regard to the oversight and admonition of the sheep and such, yet those things were subtle. So its reality is not always present, which is why the Apostle Paul is offering such admonitions in this area and others as well. But that's something for each of us individually to be mindful of. Give as we purpose, to give cheerfully, as found in verse 8. And then there are a couple of other things that are mentioned as we go down through the particular text. You'll notice in verse 11, it says, while you are enriched in everything, form all liberality, which causes thanksgiving through us to God. There is the phrase liberality that is used there. And the fact that God supplies those things that are needful to you, that you may be liberal. In verse 13, the example that is found in such a giving. In other words, if people see how liberal I am with regard to those things that I give, and this is not, again, individually that I should be showing people how much money I'm putting in the plate. What he's talking about is when it comes time for us to take that gift, when the amount of the gift is seen, then it's going to be something that is going to serve as a good example to others. They're going to be encouraged by that. We could give parallels to that. If we have a situation where saints in another part of the world are suffering because of some natural disaster, and so we make the effort to give a gift in that regard, then when they receive that gift, they're going to be encouraged by our example and our liberality. If individuals see the amount that we offer in outside support and supporting the preaching of the gospel, and they see that, they see the commitment that we make to evangelizing the lost and to supporting our fellow workers in the gospel, and they're going to see that example and they're going to be encouraged and strengthened by that. And so that's kind of where that comes in regard to this example. But the reason for their being a good example is because they were liberal in their sharing with them and with all, and because of the demonstration of God's grace that was shown through their actions, as indicated in verse 14. So all of those things are principles with regard to giving, and we've kind of touched on them. We've discussed them in the past. I wanted to make note of them, that this is a very good passage to go to in chapters 8 and 9 if we want to know what God expects of us with regard to our giving of our means. There's one final point, verse 15, that I want to make note of that I'll open up in discussion people might have. But as we began our discussion, chapter 8, verse 8, a few moments ago, we talked about the fact that Christ serves as our example of what he gave of himself, even his very life on our behalf. And I want you to notice in verse 15, after he has gone through the entirety of this discussion about their need to be committed in what they give with regard to their need to be liberal and all these things, he says, thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. And as is the case, again, applicable in every aspect of our Christian ministry, the diligence that we show in service of the Master, inclusive of our monetary giving, it is in response to what God has done for us. There should be in that a sense of obligation and duty. We do this because of what he has done for us. The Apostle Paul showed that in regard to preaching the gospel. And that is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. Titus, the second chapter, when he talks about the grace of God that has appeared to all men, it teaches us that we're to deny ungodliness and worldly lust and live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age. It's all in response to grace. As we acknowledge the nature of the gift and the value of the gift, the extent of the favor that God has granted to us, there should be a commensurate response on our part. All aspects of our lives, certainly with regard to our monetary giving, that would compel us to be liberal and to be systematic and to be purposeful, to be cheerful, zealous, loving, all of those principles as a result of what God has meant for us. And I think it's a right and proper way for the Apostle Paul to end the discussion with regard to their obligations and their duties and the instructions he gives them, to remind them of what God has done for them. And that's what he does in verse 15.
Very quickly, I would like to examine or bring up the psychology of a cheerful giver, and this would be applicable to all the attributes of a Christian. But imagine mentally here, if you were if you were denying giving, or denying prayer, or any of the other attributes of a Christian, that would bring about a sadness, I would think. So the opposite should be the cheerful giver.
Okay, that's a good point. But I don't appreciate you stealing my sermon. That's a kind of the premise of my lesson, and so we'll to touch a little bit more on that as we get into that later on this morning. Now, having said that, there are a couple of things that come up in our discussion of this that we want to make note of. There is a question, and there is also another doctrine that we may note of in chapter 8. So let's do the question very quickly, because I think we've already pretty much explained it. And that question is, what does it mean that they first gave themselves to the Lord in chapter 8, verse 5, with regard to Macedonians and their example? Not only as we hope, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. Now, what we've talked about, and the reason I bring it up again is because it was one of the questions that we had put in our outline. Again, understand the nature of our commitment. When I say the nature of our commitment, the all-encompassing nature of our commitment. Because I think that each and every one of us has an area, maybe a very big area of our life, where our commitment to the Lord is completely total. In other words, we offer up that commitment to Him without resentment. It may be with regard to, again, the majority of you who are here are very persistent and consistent with regard to your attendance to the worship services. So you've made a commitment. You've decided that because of your commitment to the Lord, it is not going to be a burden to you. You are going to be here when the doors are open. You enjoy it. It's something that is an encouraging thing to you. When it comes to making a decision as to whether you're going to come to worship services, you don't have to make that decision because why? You've dedicated yourself to the Lord. And since you dedicated yourself to the Lord, it's not necessary for you to determine whether or not you're going to fulfill this particular obligation. You're going to do it because of the decision, the commitment that you've already made. You do understand that even in this congregation and certainly in other places and other individuals, that same commitment is not there. That there are some who are not persistent and consistent in regard to their attendance to the worship. And they somewhat are somewhat resentful. I remember talking to a young lady who had only before becoming a Christian, being involved out in the denominational world, only kind of a tangential involvement with regard to religion in general. So she was someone who would come to worship on holidays, Christmas and Easter and a couple of other times, or on occasion. If she felt the need, she would go. If she didn't, she wouldn't. And after she became a Christian, she chafed under the responsibility of always being there. Why do we have to be here so often? Why do you have to come all the time? It's something she was never very comfortable with. And again, at least in part, it was an indication that she had not first given herself to the Lord because she did not persist in her commitment to the Lord either and is no longer faithful. But again, not everyone is that way. Some people sometimes become resentful of that. So that's an example. But again, I said, most of you who are here at least this morning are here this morning because you've made that commitment. And so you first give yourself to the Lord in that area. Isn't it possible, however, that there are certain aspects of our life that may be different for each of us? Or when it comes the time when I have to fulfill my responsibility in that area, then I'm a bit more hesitant, a bit more resentful. Not comfortable with it. Do I have to do it again? It was really required of me. And I want you to consider that because of this particular principle and the idea that with regard to the obligations we have as Christians, no matter what they might be, if we have given ourselves first to the Lord, then those commitments are things that are not onerous and difficult for us at all. But the things that we are more than willing to do because we have first given to the Lord. Now, I don't know what that is in your life, or even if you have one, but I want you to examine yourself as I will myself and think, is there some area that I'm a bit more hesitant and not as consistent or persistent fulfilling my responsibilities in that area? It may be with regard to personal devotions. It may be with regard to my prayer life, my Bible study. It may be with regard to sharing the gospel with the lost. It may be with regard to the benevolence that I show toward my brother or sister in Christ. And it's just something that is difficult for me to do. That if you give yourself first to the Lord, then that will help you with regard to fulfilling that commitment and being zealous then. Yes, sir.
In the last couple of weeks, there's a research come out. The first one was the fact that they discovered people with strong religious beliefs are happier in life. And they looked at several different things like sports and their job and things like this. And religion was the thing that made people the happiest. And the second thing they found out was, in a separate research, was the fact people who are religious are suffering less from depression because they've learned to not sweat small things and not be concerned about that. So religion plays a very important part in their lives as well.
Very good. One final point, and I'm not going to belabor the point, but if anyone has any further questions about this, just to acknowledge this. And that is in verses 3 and 4 with regard to the scope of benevolence. When we say the scope of benevolence, who it is that you take the money and give to it, give to them. Can we do that for anyone? And there are two answers to that question. First answer is, of course we can. If I come across an individual who is in need, I have the right to give what I desire to give to that individual to help them. I have the duty of benevolence. The Good Samaritan is a wonderful example of this. But I want you to understand something. It's a point of issue that's divided churches and led to much unscriptural activity in the past. I want you to recognize that what is specifically under consideration in this particular text and in every instance with regard to benevolence collectively shown, what we're talking about is monies gathered by a local congregation and sent, that the object of that benevolence that is done by a local congregation is to other Christians. And that's very clear. You'll notice in verses 3 and 4 in this particular case, but it's something that, as you look at the sum total of the biblical example, the biblical pattern, that this is the case. Notice verses 3 and 4. I bear witness with regard to the Macedonians. And remember 1 Corinthians 16, he said, what they've done, you need to do too. Lay by and store on the first day of the week, you've been prospered, and we'll take that gift and we'll give it to them. He said, what they did, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we should receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. Understand this. In Judea, the famine that existed was not a famine that only affected Christians. But the resources that Paul called upon Christians to gather for the purpose of sending a gift, this benevolent activity, was limited to the saints in Judea. We have an obligation to do all, the good to all, but especially to those who are in the household of faith. And there is a very special responsibility that we have as a congregation of God's people, that if we have the ability to do so, is to help during times of duress, famine, destruction, those kinds of things, brethren Christians in other places. When it comes to benevolent giving, that is money taken out of the Lord's treasury to be given in the work of benevolence, the scriptural pattern is that it is given to saints. Whenever there is a greater, more broad benevolent pattern that is shown, it is with regard to our individual responsibilities, as indicated in James, the first chapter, is indicated by the example of the Samaritan. It's indicated in 1 Timothy, the fifth chapter, that an individual who has widows, that is, your mother's widow who's destitute, that you have a responsibility as a believer to care for her so that the church will not be burdened with that. So the scope of benevolence, as is revealed in the New Testament, is limited with regard to congregational involvement. It is unlimited with regard regard to personal responsibility. And we need to acknowledge that difference. Again, verse 55 establishes very clearly where he's basically saying the church is not supposed to be doing it, and you as an individual are the ones that's supposed to be doing it. So we acknowledge that difference so we don't mix it up. And benevolence is a good work. Benevolence is an important work. But as we allude to at the beginning of our time, we could take every penny out of the church treasury that we have right now. We could go downtown and we could give it to the homeless downtown. And with all the resources that we have in the congregation, all that money is gone, and the poor will remain. And so we need to understand that our obligation and focus as a congregation with regard to the benevolent giving that we are to do is to the saints, as indicated in this text. And then, individually, there are further obligations that you enjoy, that you have, further opportunities that you have to share with those who are destitute in the world. Okay? So, we'll go on to the next section of our study next week. If anyone has any questions about this, we'll bring them up at the beginning before we